mankind as that. If you must have such a one, couldn't you have used your spell so that Gaulois would be acclaimed War Duke of Britain and Great Dragon? Then, when our son was born, you would have had your High King. The Merlin shook his head, but again it was Vivian who spoke, and this silent collusion further angered Igraine. Why should they act in concert this way against her? Vivian said softly, "You will bear no son to Gaulois, Igraine." "Are you the goddess, then, that you dispense childbearing to women in her name?" Igraine demanded rudely, knowing the words childish. "Gaulois has fathered sons by other women. Why should I not give him one born in wedlock as he desires?" Vivian didn't answer. She only looked directly at Igraine and said, her voice very soft, "Do you love Gaulois, Igraine?" Igraine stared at the floor. "That has nothing to do with it. It's a matter of honour. He was kind to me." She broke off, but her thoughts ran on unchecked. "Kind to me when I had nowhere to turn, when I was alone and deserted, and even you had abandoned me to my fate. What is love to that?" "It's a matter of honour," she repeated. "I owe him this. He let me keep Morgaine when she was all I had in my loneliness. He's been kind and patient, and for a man of his years it cannot be easy. He wants a son. He believes it all important to his life and honour, and I will not deny him this. If I bear a son, it will be the son of Duke Gaulois, and of no other man living. And this I swear by fire and..." "Silence!" Vivian's voice, like the loud clang of a great bell, shocked Igraine's words silent. "I command you, Igraine, swear no oath, lest you be forever forsworn." "And why should you think I wouldn't keep my oath?" Igraine raged. "I was reared to truth. I too am a child of the Holy Isle, Vivian. You may be my elder sister and my priestess and the Lady of Avalon, but you shall not treat me as if I were a babbling child like Morgaine there, who cannot understand a word of what is said to her, nor knows the meaning of an oath." Morgaine, hearing her name spoken, sat bolt upright in the lady's lap. The Lady of the Lake smiled and smoothed the dark hair. "Don't think that this little one cannot understand. Babies know more than we imagine. They can't speak their minds, and so we believe they don't think. As for your babe, well, that is for the future, and I will not speak of it before her. But who knows? One day she too will be a great priestess." "Never! Not if I must become a Christian to prevent it," Igraine raged. "Do you think I will let you plot against my child's life as you've plotted against mine?"
"Peace, Igraine," said the Merlin. "You are free as every child of the gods is free. We came to entreat you, not to command." "No, Vivian," he said, holding up his hand when the lady would have interrupted him. "Igraine is no helpless plaything of fate. Yet I think when she knows all, she will choose rightly." Morgaine had begun to fret in the lady's lap. Vivian crooned softly to her, stroking her hair, and she quieted. But Igraine rose and took her child, angry and jealous at Vivian's almost magical power to quiet the girl. In her arms, Morgaine felt strange, alien, as if the time she had spent in Vivian's arms had changed her, tainted her, made her somehow less Igraine's own. Igraine felt tears burning her eyes. Morgaine was all she had, and now she, too, was being cut off from her. Morgaine was falling victim, like everyone else, to Vivian's charm, that charm which could make everyone into a helpless pawn of her will. She said sharply to Morgause, who was still lying with her head in Vivian's lap, Get up at once, Morgause, and go to your room. You are almost a woman. You mustn't behave like a spoilt child. Morgause raised her head, putting back her curtain of red hair from her pretty, sulky face. She said, "Why should you choose Igraine for your plans, Vivian? She wants no part in them. But I am a woman, and I too am a daughter of the Holy Isle. Why have you not chosen me for Uther the Pendragon? Why should I not be the mother of the High King?" The Merlin smiled.
"Will you fly so recklessly in the face of fate, Morgause?"
"Why should Igraine be chosen and not I? I have no husband."
"There is a king in your future, and many sons. But with that, Morgause, you must be content. No man or woman can live another's fate. Your fate, and that of your sons, depends on this great High King." "More than that I cannot say," said the Merlin. "Enough, Morgause."
Igraine, standing, Morgaine in her arms, felt more in command. She said in a dead voice, "I am remiss in hospitality, my sister, my Lord Merlin. Let my servants take you to the guest chambers prepared for you, bring you wine and water for washing, and at sundown a meal will be prepared." Vivian rose. Her voice was formal and correct, and Igraine, for a moment, was relieved. She was again mistress of her own half, not a passive child, but the wife of Gorlois, Duke of Cornwall. "At sunset, then, my sister." But Igraine saw the glance Vivian exchanged with the Merlin, and she could read it as clearly as words. "Leave it for now. I will manage her as I have always done." And Igraine felt her face harden into iron. "That is what she has always done indeed, but this time it shall not be so. I did her will once when I was a child and knew no better, but now I am grown. I am a woman, not so easily led as the child she gave away to be Gorlois' bride. Now I will do my own will, and not that of the Lady of the Lake." Servants took her guests away. Igraine, in her own chamber, laid Morgaine in her bed, and fussed around her nervously, her mind full of what she had heard. Uther Pendragon. She had never seen him, but Gorlois was full of the tales of his valour. He was a close kinsman, sister's son, of Ambrosius Aureolanus, High King of Britain. But unlike Ambrosius, Uther was a Briton of Britons, with no taint of Roman blood, so that the Cymri and the tribes didn't hesitate to follow him. There was little doubt that one day Uther would be chosen High King. Ambrosius was not a young man. That day couldn't be so far. "And I would be queen. What am I thinking of? Would I betray Gorlois and my own honour?" Behind her, as she took up the bronze mirror again, she saw her sister in the door. Vivian had taken off the breeches she wore for riding and put on a loose gown of undyed wool. Her hair hung down, soft and dark as the wool of a black sheep. She looked small and fragile and ageing, and her eyes were the eyes of the priestess in the Cave of Initiation, years away and in another world. Igraine cut off the thought impatiently. Vivian came close to her, reaching up to touch her hair.
"Little Igraine, not so little now," she said tenderly. "Do you know, little one, I gave you your name, Granet, for the goddess of the Beltane fires. How long has it been since you did service to the goddess at Beltane, Igraine?"
Igraine's mouth only stretched a little. The smile went no deeper than her teeth.
"Gorlois is a Roman and a Christian. Do you truly believe his household keeps the rites of Beltane?"
"No, I suppose not," said Vivian, amused. "Though if I were you,
I wouldn't take oath that your servants don't slip out at midsummer to burn fires and lie together under the full moon. But lord and lady of a Christian household can't do so, not in the sight of their priests and their stern and unloving God.
Igraine said sharply, "You will not speak so of the God of my husband, who is a God of love."
"You say so. And yet he has made war upon all other gods, and slain those who will not worship him,"
Vivian said.
"Such love we might well pray to be spared in a god."
"I could call upon you in the name of vows you once made, to do what I have asked of you in the name of the goddess and the holy isle." "Oh, rare," Igraine said sarcastically. "Now my goddess demands of me that I shall play the harlot, and the Merlin of Britain and the Lady of the Lake will act as panders for me." Vivian's eyes blazed. She stepped one step forward, and for a moment Igraine believed the priestess would strike her in the face. "How do you dare?" Vivian said, and though her voice was soft, it seemed to raise echoes through the entire room, so that Morgaine, half asleep between Igraine's woolen plaid, sat up and cried out in sudden fright. "Now you have wakened my babe," Igraine said, and sat down on the edge of the bed, hushing the child. Gradually the angry colour receded from Vivian's face. She sat down beside Igraine and said, "You have not understood me, Granet.
Do you think Gaulois immortal? I tell you, child, I have sought to read in the stars the destinies of those who are vital to Britain's wholeness in the years to come. And I tell you, the name of Gaulois isn't written there."
Igraine felt her knees weaken and her whole body loosen at the joints. "Will Uther kill him?"
"I swear to you, Uther will have no part in his death. And when Gaulois dies, Uther will be far away."
"But think, child, Tintagel is a great castle." "Do you believe,
when Gaulois can hold it no longer, that Uther Pendragon would be slow to say, 'Take the castle and the woman who holds it,' to one of his war dukes? Better Uther than one of his men."
"Morgaine, what will become of my child? Of Morgause, my little sister? Truly the woman who belongs to any man must pray that he will live to protect her."
"Can I not return to the Holy Isle and live out my life in Avalon as priestess?" "That is not your destiny, little one," Vivian said. Her voice was tender again. "You can't hide from your fate. It is given to you to play a part in the salvation of this land. But the road to Avalon is closed to you for ever. Will you walk the road to your destiny, or must the gods drag you to it, unwilling?" She didn't wait for Igraine's answer. "It will not be long. Ambrosius Aureolanus is dying. For many years he has led the Britons, and now his dukes will meet to choose a high king. And there is none but Uther whom they can all trust. So Uther must be Duke of War and High King both. And he will need a son." Igraine felt as if the walls of a trap were closing around her.
"If you make so much of this, why do you not do this thing yourself? If there is so much power to be gained as the wife of Britain's War Duke and High King, why do you not seek to attract Uther with your charms, and bear this ordained king yourself?" To her surprise, Vivian hesitated for a long time before saying, "Don't you think I hadn't thought of that? But you have forgotten how old I am, Igraine. I am older than Uther, and he isn't young as warriors go. I was 26 when Morgause was born. I am 39, Igraine. And I am past childbearing." In the bronze mirror, somehow still in her hand, Igraine saw her sister's reflection, distorted, misshapen, flowing like water, the image suddenly clearing, then clouding and vanishing. Igraine said. You think so?
But I tell you that you will bear another child. I hope not, Vivian said. I'm older than our mother was when she died in bearing more girls, and I couldn't now hope to escape that fate. This is the last year I shall take part in the rites at Beltane. After this I shall hand on my office to some woman younger than I, and become as the Ancient One, the Wise Woman. I had hoped that one day I would hand on the place of the goddess to Morgawz.
Then why did you not keep her in Avalon and train her to be priestess after you? Vivian looked very sad. She is not fit.
She sees, under the mantle of the goddess, only power, not the unending sacrifice and suffering. And so that path is not for her.
It does not seem to me that you have suffered, Igraine said.
You know nothing about it. You did not choose to walk that path either. I, who have given my life to it, say still it would be simpler to live the life of a peasant woman, beast of burden, and brood mare in season. You see me robed and crowned as the goddess, triumphant beside her cauldron. You do not see the darkness of the cave or the depths of the great sea. You are not called to it, dear child, and you should thank the goddess that your destiny is laid elsewhere.
Igraine said silently, Do you think I know nothing of suffering and enduring in silence after these 4 years?
But she didn't say the words aloud.
Vivian had bent over Morgane, her face tender, stroking the little girl's silky dark hair.
Ah, Igraine, you cannot know how I envy you. All my life I've so longed for a daughter. Morgawz was like my own to me, the goddess knows. But always as alien to me as if she'd been born to a stranger, not my own mother. I longed for a daughter into whose hands I could resign my office.
She sighed. But I bore only one girl child, who died, and my sons are gone from me. She shuddered. Well, this is my destiny, which I shall try to obey as you do yours. I ask nothing of you but this, Igraine, and the rest I leave to her who is mistress of us all. When Gaulois comes home again, he will go to Londinium for the choosing of a high king. Somehow you must contrive to go there with him.
Igraine burst out laughing.
Only this, you ask me? And this is harder than all the rest.
Do you truly think that Gaulois would burden his men with escorting a young wife to Londinium?
I would like to go there indeed, but Gaulois will take me thither when figs and oranges from the south grow in the garden of Tintagel.
Nevertheless, somehow you must contrive to go, and you must look upon Uther Pendragon. Igraine laughed again.
And I suppose you will give me a charm so that he will fall so deep in love with me that he cannot resist it? Vivian stroked her curling red hair.
You are young, Igraine, and I do not think you have any idea how beautiful you are. I do not think Uther will have need of any charms.
Igraine felt her body contract in a curious, frightened spasm. Perhaps I had better have the charm, so that I will not shrink from him. Vivian sighed. She touched the moonstone about Igraine's neck. She said,
This was not Gaulois' gift to you.
No, I had it from you at my wedding, you remember? You said it was my mother's.
Give it to me.
Vivian reached under the curling hair at Igraine's neck and unfastened the chain. When this stone comes back to you, Igraine, remember what I said, and do as the goddess prompts you to do. Igraine looked at the stone in the hands of the priestess. She sighed, but she didn't protest. I have promised her nothing, she told herself fiercely. Nothing. Will you go to Londinium for the choosing of this High King, Vivian? The priestess shook her head. I go to the land of another king, who doesn't yet know that he must fight at the side of Uther. Ban, of Amorica, in Less Britain, is being made High King of his land, and, in token, his druids have told him that he must make the great rite. I am sent to officiate in the sacred marriage. I thought Brittany was a Christian land.
Oh, it is so, Vivian said indifferently, and his priests will ring their bells and anoint him with their holy oils and tell him that his God has made the sacrifice for him. But the people will not accept a king who is not himself vowed to the great sacrifice.
Igraine drew a deep breath. I know so little.
In the old days, Igraine, Vivian said. The High King was bound with his life to the fortunes of the land, and pledged, as every Merlin of Britain is pledged, that if the land comes upon disaster or perilous times, he will die that the land may live. And should he refuse this sacrifice, the land would perish. I should not speak of this. It is a mystery. But in your own way, Igraine, you too are offering your life for the healing of this land.
No woman knows, when she lies down to childbirth, whether her life will not be demanded of her at the hands of the goddess.
I too have lain bound and helpless, with the knife at my throat, knowing that if death took me, my blood would redeem the land.
Her voice trembled into silence. Igraine too was silent, in awe.
A part of Less Britain, too, has withdrawn into the mists, and the great shrine of stones cannot now be found. The avenue leading to the shrine is empty stone, unless the way to Karnak is known, Vivian said. But King Ban has pledged to keep the worlds from drifting apart, and the gateways open to the mysteries. And so he will make the sacred marriage with the land, in token that if there is need, his very blood will be spilled to feed the crops. It is fitting that my last service to the mother, before I take my place among the wise women, shall be to bind his land to Avalon. And so, I am to be the goddess to him in this mystery.
She was silent, but for Igraine, the room was filled with the echo of her voice.
Vivian bent over and picked up the sleeping Morgaine in her arms, holding her with great tenderness. "She is not yet a maiden, and I not yet a wise woman," she said. "But we are the three, Igraine. Together we make up the goddess, and she is here, present among us."
Igraine wondered why she had not named their sister Morgause, and they were so open to one another that Vivian heard the words as if Igraine had spoken them aloud.
She said in a whisper, and Igraine saw her shiver,
"The goddess has a fourth face which is secret,
and you should pray to her, as I do. As I do, Igraine, that Morgause will never wear that face."
Chapter 3. It seemed to Igraine that she had been riding for ever in the rain. The journey to Londinium was like a journey from the end of the world. She had travelled but little before, except long ago, from Avalon to Tintagel. She contrasted the frightened, despairing child of that first journey with herself today.
Now she rode at Gorlois's side,
and he went to some trouble to tell her something of the lands they passed through. And she laughed and teased him. And at night, in their tent, she went willingly to his bed. Now and again she missed Morgaine, wondering how the child would be faring. Would she cry at night for her mother? Would she eat at Morgause's bidding? But it was pleasant to be free again, riding in this great company of men, conscious of their admiring looks and their deference. None of them would dare to approach Gorlois's lady, except with an admiring glance. She was a girl again, but not now, frightened and shrinking from the strange man who was her husband, and whom she must somehow manage to please. She was a girl again, without the childish awkwardness of her real girlhood, and she was enjoying it. She didn't even mind the ceaseless rain that obscured the distant hills, so that they rode within a little circle of mist. "We could lose our way in this mist, wander off into the realms of faery, and never return at all to this world, where the dying Ambrosius and the ambitious Uther planned for the salvation of Britain from the wild savages. Britain could sink like Rome under the barbarians, and we need never know nor care."
"Are you weary, Igraine?"
Goloise's voice was gentle and concerned. Really, he wasn't the ogre he had seen during those first terrifying days 4 years ago. Now he was only an aging man, grey in his hair and beard, though he shaved himself carefully in Roman fashion, scarred from years of fighting, and touchingly eager to please her. Perhaps if she hadn't been so frightened and rebellious in those days, she might have seen that he was eager to please her then, too. He hadn't been cruel to her. Or if he was, it was only that he seemed to know little of women's bodies and how to use them. Now it seemed only clumsiness, not cruelty. And if she told him he hurt her, he would caress her more gently. The younger Igraine had thought it inevitable, the hurt and the terror. Now she knew better. She smiled at him now, gaily, and said, "No, not at all. I feel I could go on riding for ever. But with so much mist, how do you know that we will not lose our way, and never come to Londinium at all?"
"You need not fear that," he said gravely. "My guides are very good, and they know every inch of the road. And before nightfall we will come to the old Roman road which leads into the very heart of the city. So we will sleep this night under a roof and in a proper bed."
"I shall be glad to sleep again in a proper bed," said Igraine demurely,
and saw, as she had known she would see, the sudden heat rising in his face and eyes.
But he turned his face away from her. It was almost as if he was afraid of her. And Igraine, having just discovered this power, delighted in it. She rode on at his side, reflecting on the sudden kindness she felt for Gaulois, a kindness mixed with regret, as if he had become dear to her only now, when she knew she must lose him.
One way or another, she knew her days at his side were numbered, and she remembered how she had first known that he would die.
She had had his messenger, warning her to prepare for his coming. He had sent one of his men with suspicious eyes, which peered everywhere, telling Igraine without words that if this man had had a young wife, he would have come home without warning, hoping to surprise some misconduct or extravagance. Igraine, knowing herself guiltless, her steward competent, her kitchen in order, had ignored the prying stares and bade the man welcome. Let him question her servants if he would. He would find that except for her sister and the Lord Merlin, she had received no guests at Tintagel. When the messenger had gone, Igraine, turning to cross the courtyard, had stopped, a shadow falling across her in full sunlight, stricken with causeless fear. And in that moment she saw Gaulois, wondering where was his horse, his entourage. He looked thinner and older, so that for a moment she hardly knew him, and his face was drawn and haggard. There was a sword cut on his cheek, which she didn't remember. "My husband!" she cried. "Gaulois!" And then, stricken by the unspeakable grief in his face, she had forgotten her fear of him and the years of resentment, rushed toward him, and spoken as she would have spoken to her child. "Oh, my dear, what has happened to you? What has brought you here like this, alone, unarmed? Are you ill? Are you?
And then she stopped, her voice dying away among the echoes. For there was no one there, only the fitful light from clouds and sea and shadows, and the echo of her own voice. She tried, all the rest of that day, to reassure herself that it was only ascending, like the one that had warned her of Vivian's coming. But she knew better. Gorlois had not the sight, would not have used it or believed in it if he had had it. What she had seen, and she knew it even though she had never seen anything like it before, was her husband's fetch, his double, the shadow and precursor of his death. And when at last he arrived, whole and sound, she had tried to shrug away the memory, had told herself that it was only a trick of the light that made her see, behind him, the shadow she had seen, with the sword cut on his face and the unspeakable grief in his eyes. For Gorlois now was neither wounded nor disheartened. On the contrary, he was in high good humour, bringing gifts for her, and even a string of little coral beads for Morgaine. He had looked in the sacks of his Saxon plunder, and given Morgors a red cloak. No doubt it belonged to some Saxon strumpet, some camp follower, or even one of the screaming swordswomen who fight alongside their men, half-naked on the field of war, he said, laughing and chucking the girl under the chin. So it is just as well it should be worn by a decent British maiden. The colour becomes you, little sister. When you have grown a bit, you will be as pretty as my wife. Morgors had simpered and giggled and tossed her head, posing in the new cloak. And later, Gorlois had said sharply, as he and Ygraine were making themselves ready for bed, Morgaine, howling, had been banished to Morgors's room. We must have that girl married as soon as can be arranged, Ygraine. She is a puppy bitch with eyes hot for anything in the shape of a man. Did you see how she cast her eyes not only on me, but on my younger soldiers? I will not have such a one disgracing my family, nor influencing my daughter. Ygraine had given him a soft answer. She could not forget that she had seen Gorlois's death, and she would not argue with a condemned man. And she, too, had been annoyed by Morgors's behaviour.
So, Gorlois is to die. Well, it takes not much prophecy to foresee that a man of 45, who has been fighting Saxons much of his life, will not live to see his little children grown. I shall not let it make me believe all the rest of the nonsense she spoke to me, or I shall be expecting Gorlois to take me to Londinium. But the next day, as they lingered over breaking their fast, and she was mending a great rent in his best tunic, he spoke bluntly.
Did you not wonder what brought me here so suddenly, Ygraine?
After the night passed, she had the confidence to smile into his eyes. Should I question fortune which has brought my husband home after a year's absence? I hope it means that the Saxon shores are free and in British hands again. He nodded absently and smiled. Then the smile was gone.
Ambrosius Aurelianus is dying. The old eagle will soon be gone, and there is no hatchling to fly in his place. It is like the legions going again. He has been high king for all my days, and a good king for those of us who still hoped, as I did, for the return of Rome one day. Now I know that day will never come. The kings of Britain, from near and far, have been summoned to gather in Londinium to choose their high king and war leader, and I too must go. It was a long journey to stay so little time, for I must be off again within 3 days. But I would not come so near without seeing you and the child. It will be a great gathering, Ygraine, and many of the dukes and kings will bring their ladies. Would you like to come with me?
To Londinium?
"Yes, if you will travel so far," he said, "and if you can bring yourself to leave that child." "I don't know why you should not. Morgaine is healthy and sound, and there are enough women here to look after a dozen like her. And if I have managed to get you with child again..." He met her eyes in a smile she could hardly have imagined on his face. "It will not yet hinder you in riding." There was a tenderness she had never guessed in his voice as he added, "I would rather not be parted from you again for a little while, at least. Will you come, my wife?" "Somehow you must contrive to come to Londinium with him," Vivian had said it. And now Gaulois had made it unnecessary even to ask. Igraine had a sudden feeling of panic, as if she were on a runaway horse. She picked up a cup of beer and sipped at it to cover her confusion. "Certainly I will come if you wish it." 2 days later they were on the road, riding eastward to Londinium and the encampment of Uther Pendragon and the dying Ambrosius, for the choosing of a high king. In mid-afternoon they came to the Roman road, and could ride more swiftly, and late that day they could see the outskirts of Londinium, and smell the tidal river that washed its shores. Igraine had never guessed so many houses could be gathered together in one place. For a moment she felt, after the chill spaces of the southern moors, that she couldn't breathe, that the houses were closing in on her. She rode as if in a trance, feeling that the stone streets and walls cut her off from air and light and life itself. How could people live behind walls this way? "We will sleep this night at the home of one of my soldiers who has a house in the city," Gaulois said. "And tomorrow we will present ourselves at the court of Ambrosius." She asked him that night, seated before the fire. What luxury, she thought, a fire this near to midsummer. "Who, think you, will be the next High King?" "What can it matter to a woman who rules the land?" She smiled sidelong at him. She had taken down her hair for the night, and she could feel him warming to the smile. "Even though I am a woman, Gaulois, I must live in this land, and I would like to know what manner of man my husband must follow in peace and war."
"Peace? There will be no peace in my lifetime, at least," Gaulois said. "Not with all those wild folk coming to our rich shores. We must gather all our strength to defend ourselves. And there are many who would like to wear the mantle of Ambrosius and lead us in war. Lot of Orkney, for instance. A harsh man, but reliable, a strong leader, good at battle strategy. Still unmarried, though, no dynasty. He's young for a high king, but ambitious. Never knew a man of that age so ambitious. And Urien's of North Wales. No problems with dynasty. He already has sons. But the man has no imagination. Wants to do everything as it's always been done. Says that it worked once, and it will work again. And I suspect he's no good Christian."
"Which would be your choice?" Igraine asked. He sighed.
"Neither," he said. "I have followed Ambrosius all my life, and I will follow the man Ambrosius has chosen. It's a matter of honour, and Uther is Ambrosius's man. It's as simple as that. Not that I like Uther. He's a lecherous man with a dozen bastards, no woman safe around him. He goes to mass because the army does, and because it's the thing to do. I'd rather he was an honest pagan than a Christian for the benefits he can get from it."
"Yet you support him?"
"Oh, yes. He's soldier enough for a Caesar. The men will follow him through hell if they have to. He spares no effort to be popular with the army. You know the kind of thing. Going around the camp and munching on their rations to make sure they're fit to eat.
spending a day when he could be taking his ease in going to the quartermaster's to get a discharge for an old toothless veteran, sleeping in the field with the men before a battle. The men would die for him, and they do. And he has both brains and imagination. He managed to make peace with the treaty troops and get them to fight alongside us last fall. He thinks a little too much like a Saxon for me. He knows how their minds work. Yes, I'll support him. But that doesn't mean I like the man.
Igraine, listening, thought that Gaulois had revealed more of himself than of the other candidates for High King. She said at last, "Have you never thought? You are Duke of Cornwall, and Ambrosius values you. Could you be chosen as High King?"
"Believe me, Igraine, I want no crown. Have you a wish to be queen?"
"I would not refuse it," she said, recalling the Merlin's prophecy.
"You say that because you are too young to know what it means," Gaulois said with a smile. "Would you truly like to rule a kingdom as you must rule over your servants at Tintagel, at everyone's beck and call?" "There was a time when I was younger. But I do not want to spend the rest of my lifetime at war. Ambrosius gave me Tintagel years ago, Igraine. Until 4 years ago, I hadn't spent enough time there to bring home a wife. I will defend these shores as long as I can hold a sword. But I want a son to play with my daughter, and some time to spend in peace, fishing from the rocks and hunting, and sitting in the sun watching the peasant folk bring in their crops, and time, perhaps, to make my peace with God, so that he may forgive me for all the things I have had to do in a life as a soldier. But even when there is peace in the land, the High King has no peace. For when the enemies leave our shore, why, then his friends begin to fight, if only for his favour. No, there will be no crown for me, and when you are my age, you will be glad of it."
Igraine felt a pricking behind her eyes as Gaulois spoke. So this harsh soldier, the sombre man she had feared, now felt enough at ease with her to reveal something of his wishes. With all her heart she wished that he might have his last few years in the sun as he wished, his children playing about him. But even here, in the flickering of the fire, she thought she could see the ominous shadow of the doom that followed him. "It is my imagination. I have let the words of the Merlin make me imagine foolish things," she told herself. And when Gaulois yawned and stretched, saying that he was weary from riding, she went quickly to help him take off his clothes. She hardly slept in the strange bed, turning and tossing as she listened to Gaulois's quiet breathing. Now and again he reached out for her in his sleep, and she soothed him against her breast as she would have done with her child. "Perhaps," she thought, "the Merlin and the lady were frightened by their own shadows. Perhaps Gaulois will indeed have time to grow old in the sun. Perhaps, before he slept, he had indeed planted in her womb the seed of the sun they said he would never father." But toward morning she fell into fitful sleep, dreaming of a world in the mist, of the shoreline of the Holy Isle receding further and further in the mists. It seemed to Igraine that she was rowing on a barge, heavy and exhausted, seeking for the Isle of Avalon, where the goddess, wearing Vivian's face, was waiting to ask her how well she had done what was required of her. But although the shoreline was familiar, and the groves of apple trees which had grown on the shore when she came up to the temple, a crucifix stood in the temple of her dream, and a choir of the black-robed nuns of the Christians was singing one of their doleful hymns. And when she began to run, looking everywhere for her sister, the sound of church bells drowned out her cries. She woke with a stifled whimper, a sleeper's scream, and sat up to hear the sound of church bells everywhere. Gaulois sat up in bed beside her.
"It is the church where Ambrosius goes to mass. Make haste to dress yourself, Ygraine, and we will go together."
While she was winding a woven silk girdle around her linen overdress, a strange serving man knocked at the door, saying he would like to speak with a Lady Ygraine, wife of the Duke of Cornwall. Ygraine went to the door, and it seemed to her that she recognised the man. He bowed to her, and now she remembered that she had seen him years ago, rowing Vivian's barge. It made her remember her dream, and she felt cold inside.
"Your sister sends you this from the Merlin," he said, "and bids you to wear it and remember your promise. No more."
He gave her a small parcel wrapped in silk.
"What is this, Ygraine?" asked Gaulois, frowning, coming up behind her. "Who is sending you gifts? Do you recognize the messenger?"
"He is one of my sister's men from the Isle of Avalon," said Ygraine, unwrapping the package. But Gaulois said sternly,
"My wife does not receive gifts from messengers unknown to me,"
and took it roughly from her. She opened her mouth in indignation, all her new tenderness for Gaulois vanishing in a single breath. How dared he?
"Why, it is the blue stone you wore when we were wedded," Gaulois said, frowning. "What is this of a promise? How did your sister, if it is truly from her, come by the stone?"
Gathering her wits quickly, Ygraine lied to him deliberately for the first time in her life. "When my sister visited me," she said, "I gave her the stone and its chain to have the clasp put right. She knows of a goldsmith in Avalon who is better than any in Cornwall. And the promise she spoke of is that I will care better for my jewels, since I am now a grown woman and not a heedless child who cannot take proper care of precious things. May I have my necklace, my husband?" He handed her the moonstone, frowning.
"I have smiths in my employ who would have put it right for you without reading you a lesson your sister no longer has a right to give. Vivian takes too much upon herself. She may have stood in a mother's place to you when you were a child, but you are not now in her care. You must strive to be more a grown woman and less dependent upon your home."
"Why, now I have had two lessons," said Ygraine crossly, putting the chain about her neck. "One from my sister, and one from my husband, as if I were an unlessoned child indeed." Over his head it seemed that she could still see the shadow of his death, the dread fetch of the death-doomed. Suddenly she hoped, with a passionate hope, that he hadn't gotten her with child, that she didn't bear a son to a doomed man. She felt icy cold.
"Come, Ygraine," he coaxed, putting out his hand to stroke her hair. "Do not be angry with me. I shall try to remember that you are a grown woman in your 19th year, not a mere child of 15. Come, we must be ready to go to the King's Mass, and the priests do not like it if there's much coming and going after the Mass has started."
The church was small, made of daub and wattle, and the lamps inside were lighted against the cold dankness. Ygraine was glad of her thick woolen mantle. Gaulois whispered to her that the white-haired priest, venerable as any druid, was Ambrosius's own priest who travelled with the army, and that this was a service of thanksgiving for the king's homecoming. "Is the king here?"
"He is just coming into the church, at the seat over there before the altar," Gaulois muttered, inclining his head.
She knew him at once by the dark red mantle worn over a dark, heavily embroidered tunic, and the jewelled sword belt at his side. Ambrosius Aurelianus must, she thought, have been about 60. A tall, spare man, shaven in the Roman fashion, but stooped, walking with a careful crouch, as if he had some inner hurt. Once, perhaps, he had been handsome. Now his face was lined and yellow, his dark moustache drooping, nearly all grey, and his hair grizzled. Beside him were two or three of his counsellors or fellow kings. She wanted to know who they were, but the priest, seeing the king enter, had begun reading from his great book, and she bit her lip and was silent, listening to the service which even now, after 4 years in Father Columba's instruction, she didn't fully understand, nor care to. She knew it was ill-mannered to gaze about her in church like a country bumpkin, but she peeped below the hood of her mantle at some of the men around the king. A man whom she supposed to be Urien's of North Wales, and a richly dressed man, slender and handsome, dark hair cut short in Roman fashion around his chin. She wondered if this was Uther, Ambrosius's companion and heir apparent. He stood attentively at Ambrosius's side all through the long service, and when the aging king stumbled, the slight dark man offered him an arm. He cast his eyes attentively on the priest, but Igraine, trained to read people's thoughts in their faces, knew that he wasn't really listening to the priest or to the service, but that his thoughts ran inward on their own purposes. He raised his head once and looked straight at Gaulois, and briefly met Igraine's eyes. His own eyes were dark beneath heavy, dark brows, and Igraine felt an instantaneous shiver of revulsion. If this was Uther, she resolved, she would have nothing to do with him. A crown would be too dearly bought at his side. He must be older than he looked, for this man was surely no more than 25. Partway through the service, there was a little stir near the door, and a tall, soldierly man, broad-shouldered but lanky, in a thick woven plaid like those the Northmen wore, came into the church, followed by 4 or 5 soldiers. The priest went on, unruffled, but the deacon, who stood at his side, raised his head from the gospel book and scowled. The tall man uncovered his head, revealing fair hair already worn thin and balding on top. He moved through the standing congregation. The priest said, "Let us pray," and as Igraine knelt, she saw the tall, fair-haired man and his soldiers quite near them. His soldiers had knelt around Gaulois's men, and the man himself was at her side. When he had gotten himself down on his knees, he gave one quick look round to see that all of his men were placed, then bent his head piously to listen to the prayer. Through all the long service, he didn't raise his head. Even when the congregation began to approach the altar for the consecrated bread and wine, he did not go. Gaulois touched Igraine's shoulder, and she went at his side. The Christians held that a wife should follow her husband's faith. So that God of theirs could just blame Gaulois if she went to the communion ill-prepared. Father Columba had argued with her a long time about proper prayer and preparation, and Igraine had decided that she was never properly prepared for it. But Gaulois would be angry with her, and after all, she couldn't interrupt the silence of the service to argue with him, even in a whisper. Returning to her place, her teeth on edge from the coarse bread and the sourness of wine on an empty stomach, she saw the tall man raise his head. Gaulois gave him a curt nod and passed on. The man looked at Igraine, and it seemed for a moment that he was laughing at her, and at Gaulois too. She felt herself smile. Then, at Gaulois' repressive frown, she followed him and knelt meekly at his side. But she could see the fair-haired man watching her. From his Northman's plaid, she supposed that this could be Lot of Orkney, the one Gaulois had called young and ambitious. Some of the Northmen, too, were fair as Saxons. The final psalm had begun. She listened to the words without paying much attention to them.
He has sent redemption among his people in accordance with his eternal covenant. His name is holy and terrible. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom.
Gaulois bowed his head for the benediction. She was learning so much about her husband in these few days.
She had known he was a Christian when she married him. Indeed, most folk were Christian in these days. Or if they were not, they kept it most scrupulously to themselves, except near the Holy Isle where the old faith reigned, or among the northern barbarians, or the Saxons. But she hadn't known that he was genuinely pious.
The benediction was over. The priest and his deacons departed, bearing their long cross and the holy book. Igraine looked to where the king stood. He looked yellow and tired, and as he turned to leave the church, he leaned heavily on the arm of the dark young man who had stood next to him and supported him all through the service.
"Lot of Orkney loses no time, does he, my Lord of Cornwall?" said the tall, fair-haired man in the Northman's plaid. "He is ever at Ambrosius's elbow these days, and not wanting in service."
"So," Igraine thought, "this is not the Duke of Orkney, as I thought."
Gaulois grunted assent. "Your lady wife, Gaulois?" "Reluctantly, churlishly," Gaulois said. "Igraine, my dear, this is our war-duke, Uther, whom the tribes call Pendragon, from his banner."
She dropped him a curtsy, blinking with astonishment. "Uther Pendragon, this ungainly man, fair as a Saxon. Was this the courtier intended to succeed Ambrosius? This bumbling man who blundered in to disturb Holy Mass?" Uther was staring, not, Igraine realised, at her face, but at something lower down. And Igraine, wondering if she had spilled communion wine on her gown, saw that he was staring at the moonstone on the breast of her mantle. She wondered sharply if he had never seen one before.
Gaulois, too, had noted the direction of his gaze. He said, "I would like to present my lady to the king. A good day to you, my lord duke,"
and left without waiting for Uther's farewell. When they were out of earshot, he said,
"I like not the way he looks at you, Igraine. He is no man for a decent woman to know. Avoid him."
Igraine said, "He was not looking at me, my husband, but at the jewel I wore. Is he greedy for riches?"
"He is greedy for all things," Uther said shortly,
walking so swiftly that Igraine's thin shoes stumbled on the stone street. They had overtaken the royal party. Ambrosius, surrounded by his priests and counsellors, looked like any other elderly sick man who had gone fasting to Mass and was ready for his breakfast and a place to sit down. He walked with one hand held to his side as if it hurt him, but he smiled at Gaulois with real friendliness, and Igraine knew why the whole of Britain had made up their quarrels to serve under this man and fight away the Saxons from their shores.
"Why, Gaulois, are you back so swiftly from Cornwall? I had little hope of seeing you here before the council or again in this world," he said.
His voice was thin, breathy, but he held out his arms to Gaulois, who embraced the old man carefully, then blurted out,
"You are ill, my lord. You should have kept your bed."
Ambrosius said with a little smile,
"I will keep it soon enough, and long enough, I fear. The bishop said as much, and would have brought me the holy things in my bed if I wished. But I wanted to show myself among you again. Come and breakfast with me, Gaulois, and tell me how all goes in your quiet countryside."
The two men walked on, Igraine walking behind her husband. On the king's other side was the slight dark man, scarlet-clad, Lot of Orkney.